AI is the new hot buzzword and all the rage these days, all sparked by the release of ChatGPT a few months ago. Now, since then, everyone and their brother has used OpenAI software in fascinating and sometimes scary ways. So this week, I jumped into ChatGPT and asked it to come up with the top questions about options trading that new and advanced users are asking right now. Now, not only did it whip up a list of 15 questions wicked fast, it typed 15 amazing questions that actually serve as the basis and outline for this week's podcast.
You're listening to the Option Alpha podcast from OptionAlpha.com, where we show you how to make smarter trades, learn how the stock market really works, and generate consistent monthly income. Now, your host and head trader at OptionAlpha.com, Kirk Duplessis.
Hey everyone, this is Kirk here again at Option Alpha, working every single week to make this the most popular investing podcast offered online because it's based on one thing and one thing only, and that's helping you consistently place smarter trades. So thank you again so much for tuning in today and welcome back. Now, truthfully, I didn't know where to start back up the podcast episode because we did a series of podcasts and I was like, man, I have no idea where we should go with this. There's lots of questions, lots of topics we could dive into, but I really wanted to focus this week's podcast on, again, another deep dive into the education side. That's always been our focus here at Option Alpha, is trying to educate traders, new traders, experienced traders, try to help everyone collectively in this community understand options trading a little bit better. So I figured, you know what, AI is all the buzz these days. And it's the rage. Everyone and their brother is using it. So why not use ChatGPT and try to see if it can come up with some questions? And again, like I said in the intro, not only did it come up with questions wicked fast, and I find myself in a rabbit hole of like other topics that we could discuss and go through, which I made a massive list for in the future, but it came up with some really good questions, ones that I think kind of really hit a lot of bases in one single list of questions. So I've got 15 questions, all from ChatGPT. I asked it to give me about 25 or so, narrowed the list down to the ones I thought were really, really helpful and kind of hit a lot of bases. So that's going to be the list today. These come directly from using AI and ChatGPT, and essentially, I guess it's from learning what other people are already asking out there. I did a little bit of pre-framing. I said, look, we're going to do a podcast for options traders. We don't want to talk about crypto. We want to talk about options. We don't want to talk about stocks necessarily. We want to talk about options. And so it's a little bit of massaging it, if you will, to get to a list of like, what are traders asking? And I deliberately said new people, like people who are just coming in to options trading, brand new, maybe never have experienced or heard of options trading before. And so really this podcast is for you. So if you're brand new, you're never traded options before, don't know how they work, I hope that this is a great primer because we're truly going to hit a lot of different bases on today's show. So in the rest of the show, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through the list of questions that ChatGPT pulled up. These are not necessarily in any particular order, though I do think that the list that it pulled up, because I told it to put it in an order that seemed relevant for a show and to describe options to people, put it into a really good working list. So I want to go through these 15 questions. As always, we'll have additional resources and links in the show notes page over at optionalpha.com/show229. Again, that's just the number 229, optionalpha.com/show229. You get all those resources plus links to all of our free education and training all in there, and you can dive into this deep watering hole of options trading as much as you want. Okay, all right, so let's get started. All right, so question number one that ChatGPT came up with was, what are options and how do they work? And I got to be honest, when I first saw this question, I was thinking to myself, oh my gosh, ChatGPT, like you just asked the deepest question that you could possibly ask. Like there's, you know, how does the universe work? How does everything work? And how does nature work? You know, and it's, to me, it's not so deep, like how does the universe work? But it is not an easy question to answer because there is a little bit of nuance in here. So here's how I'm going to try to describe it. And I think that this will help out because I think this helps me when I try to understand it myself. It's even now when I still try to understand and explain it to people, I explain it this way. So let's start first by understanding just stock. I think everyone who's listening to this podcast probably understands what a stock is. A stock is just a share of a company. And you know that you can buy and sell stock. Now, your goal in buying and selling stock is to buy stock generally at a low price and then sell it at a high price, right? And everyone understands that. You buy stock for $10, you sell it for $25, and now you make, you know, $15 and you've got this profit. Great, that's easy. Options contracts are essentially a derivative trading instrument that sits on top of those shares of stock or ETFs or indexes, whatever it is that you're trading. And what I mean by this is that they derive their value from that underlying contract. And the way that they do that is you make essentially a side agreement. And I know that's not the technical term for it, but it's the way that I describe it is you're making a side agreement, which is essentially the derivative, right? That you're agreeing with somebody else on the side, not tied to the actual security directly. You're not buying and selling the shares of the security. You're making this kind of side agreement with somebody else in order to give you the choice. And this is where the term option comes in. The option as a buyer of that contract to buy or sell the underlying shares with that other person at a specific price in the future or before. That's it. So an option contract in its most basic terms is simply an exchange of risk, an exchange or a transfer of risk, where you are choosing to participate in the buying or selling of the underlying stock at a specific price on or before a specific date in the future. Now, there's a couple key elements that get thrown in there, right? It's not so easy like stock where it's like, oh, I'm just going to buy stock or I'm going to sell stock. There's these terms that I've thrown in there like I'm going to buy stock or sell stock. And again, I'm making the side agreement with somebody else to buy or sell stock at a specific price on or before a specific date in the future. And so now you have these constraints that get added to an option contract. The constraint of an expiration date, this contract expires at some point. And you also have this constraint of you're determining the price at which you will buy or sell the underlying stock right now as you're trading or making this side agreement with this person. And so now what we call that specific price is we call it the strike price. The price that I've always, or the way that I've always described it was that it's the price at which you are striking a deal with this other person. So you're saying, look, I will buy stock of XYZ company at this price on or before this date in the future. That's essentially how option contracts work. That's one side of an option contract. That's called a call option. We'll get into that here in a minute. But that's what you're doing. You're not making, unlike stock, where you're saying, look, I'm going to buy stock or I'm going to sell stock right now. No, no. Options contracts give you the choice, the opportunity to buy or sell the stock at a specific price on or before a specific date in the future. Okay, so I've said that already, but let me give you a concrete example. Now, I've used this example and it's been in our training and materials, and people who've watched this know that this, in fact, somebody actually sent me a coupon to Arby's because of this, or a gift card to Arby's a long time ago because of this, but I am a big fan of Arby's roast beef sandwiches. I do not eat them every day, don't eat them every week, but man, if I get a chance to, I would definitely eat an Arby's roast beef sandwich. Judge me all you want, I still love them. Okay, but an Arby's roast beef sandwich has had a coupon before. And this is why I tell people options trading is not that complicated, because you already are using options right now. If you've ever used a coupon, if you've ever looked at a coupon, if your mom or dad has ever used a coupon, your grandma's used a coupon, they have essentially traded options. They just didn't know it. They didn't know that they were trading options. But if you had a coupon for an Arby's roast beef sandwich, and that coupon gave you a roast beef sandwich and a small fry and a drink and whatever, and that coupon said you could take this coupon and you could come into Arby's and you could give the person the coupon and you could get this whole roast beef combo set for $3.99. That whole thing, that coupon, is essentially an options contract. And so here's how it works. I want to break it down so you understand that. If you've, again, if you've ever used a coupon, I swear you're going to look at coupons completely different. Are you at that point, when you get that coupon, right? Like, let's say I just hand you that coupon for right now. I say, look, here's a coupon for a roast beef sandwich for $3.99 with fries and drink and everything. If I hand you that coupon, have you actually gone into the store yet and bought the roast beef sandwich? No. Are you physically standing in the store? Maybe, but probably not. I'm probably just handing it to you because we're friends, right? Has Arby's made the roast beef sandwich? know. They haven't made it yet, right? Like, they don't know that necessarily that you've got this coupon out there and that the coupon's swapping hands between people. So the coupon is basically trading in a side market, in this like side derivative market. It's not physically, we're not physically handing, you know, roast beef sandwiches back and forth. And so this is, again, it's a very crude example of it. And I know a lot of people are like, well, that's not technically how it works. And I get that. But it's an example that shows you that options trading is this derivative market that is trading around and on top of, inside and outside of the actual underlying shares. But they're not, you're not actually trading the shares directly. You could in the future, right? We could turn this coupon in and convert it to a physical roast beef sandwich that you can eat, but you haven't done that yet. So let's break down the coupon here. In this case, we are using this coupon, and let's say you have the coupon in your hand, and it says you can get a roast beef combo for $3.99. Well, that is a specific price, and that price is the strike price of the option contract or coupon that you are holding, because that coupon, that option contract, has a specified price at which you can buy the underlying asset. And in this case, the underlying asset or security is not a stock, it's not an ETF, it's a roast beef combo. That's the asset. That's the thing you can do with this. You can choose to exercise this. That's the term we use in options trading. We can choose to exercise this contract. And in that case, you would physically walk into the Arby's and hand the person over the counter this coupon that says, hey, I can buy this roast beef sandwich for $3.99. And then they got to give you the roast beef sandwich because that's their deal, right? Now, this coupon also has an expiration date. Now, the original coupon that I had in videos is what tells you how old these videos are and how long I've been talking about this coupon was May 30th, 2009. I don't know if I did the video right at May, but I think I did the video right afterwards, but I've been talking about this for a long time. But whatever the expiration date is, every coupon has an expiration date. It might be this month, it might be next week, it might be 2 weeks from now. And so the reason that it has an expiration date is because it can't just linger out there forever, right? Companies are smart. They know prices change and their products change, right? And for that reason too, companies will give an expiration date to their coupon. Like, you have to use this coupon by a certain date. So now, in the very simple analogy of this Arby's roast beef coupon, you now can see that options contracts essentially behave the exact same way. They have a defined price, right? The strike price of what you are going to buy at what price. And then they have an expiration date. They have a time in which they're no longer valid. So if I go into Arby's and I say, look, this coupon that we used in our videos was 2009. But if I try to take that coupon in and say, hey, I want a roast beef sandwich for $3.99, the person behind the counter would say, look, this coupon expired. Like, it's no longer good. So there's a definitive date in which the contract dies or expires, and you have to make a choice before that date. Now, let me take this one step a little bit further, and I hope you guys are enjoying this. If you are, or if you're stopping for an Arby sandwich, think of me right now as you're like, hey, you know, I'm gonna stop for an Arby sandwich. But I hope you are enjoying this because it does give you a good example of how you're using coupons already today. Okay, so let's take this one step further. So let's say that right now at Arby's, you could buy a roast beef combo. But because of inflation and all this other stuff, the roast beef combo is actually more like $8.99, which actually probably is not too far out of the realm of possibility. If you have this coupon right now, let's say this coupon didn't expire for another year, didn't expire, you know, 10 plus years ago, it still was valid, then that coupon has intrinsic value right now. Would you agree? Well, yeah, because you can take this coupon in and you can use this coupon to buy roast beef combo for $3.99, when the reality is that the value of that roast beef combo is actually $8.99. So therein lies the value of buying and selling and trading option contracts, is when you are buying and selling option contracts and trading these, there's value around the coupon and the strike price and the expiration date, how long the coupon is, as it relates, or the derivative value as it relates back to the underlying price, the underlying asset that that option contract is trading on. In this case, a roast beef combo. Now, if you went into Arby's and you choose to exercise this coupon, Well, technically, you're up some money on this thing. You could have spent $8.99 to buy a roast beef combo, but instead you've got this awesome coupon and it's $3.99. So that's what you pay. You pay $3.99 to Arby's. And that's great because now you're essentially in the money. You've saved $5, right? That's something that you didn't have to outlay before. Now, what if I told you that I had that coupon right now and I could give that coupon to you, but that coupon cost you a dollar between me and you? So you're sitting there and you're like, hey, Arby's roast beef sandwiches are right now about $8.99. So I know that Kirk has this coupon for $3.99, but I told you maybe this coupon, it might cost you a couple dollars because I know that this coupon has value right now. Maybe I say, hey, this coupon costs you $4.99 or $5.10 or something like that. I know that there's value in this coupon. Now, I may have gotten the coupon from somebody else when Arby's roast beef sandwiches were way cheaper. And so I bought this coupon when roast beef sandwiches were $2.99. And I was just speculating that, hey, maybe the cost of roast beef sandwiches are going to go up. So I bought this coupon from somebody else, and then I could trade this coupon to you. And that's where options trading comes in. It's just this trading mechanism based on the change in the value of that coupon. Now, the coupon itself, and this is a key component of understanding this, the coupon itself is not altering or changing. It's still a $3.99 coupon for a roast beef sandwich with a fixed expiration date. And every day we get closer to that expiration date, but the strike price of that coupon doesn't change. What changes is the value of that coupon as the price of the underlying asset changes. So as the price of roast beef sandwiches goes up and down, the value of this coupon starts to go up and down. And as this coupon nears expiration, the value of this coupon starts to diminish. If the expiration is really far out, well, this coupon is very valuable because I can hold it for a long time. If this coupon is really, really short, like it expires tomorrow, well, probably doesn't have much value, right? Because it expires tomorrow. It's a very short trade. If I got to either use the coupon or lose it tomorrow. That's it. So I hope just going through this really helped you understand, again, just the basics of what options are. They're just these contracts that trade side on the side or on top, however you think about it, on top of an underlying asset or market, like a stock or an ETF or index or futures. I mean, they can trade on anything. And they're just side agreements and deals to trade the underlying asset at a fixed price on or before a certain date in the future. Now, we'll get into more of the specifics here as we go, but that's basically what you're doing, is you're trading coupons and the value of coupons between people back and forth in different markets. I hope this was super helpful. I know it was maybe a different way of explaining it than maybe you've heard before, but if it was helpful, please let us know. We'd love to know, okay? Number two, and we'll get into some of these topics as we keep going here in the podcast because it kind of comes circles back around, but I want to keep these in order of how ChatGPT asks these and how you can use these for trading, okay? So number two, how much money do I need to start trading options? Well, the simple answer to this question is, you know, you probably don't need a lot of money. And the more complicated answer to this question is, just because you don't need a lot of money to start doesn't mean it's a great idea to trade options with no money or little money. And it doesn't mean that you're going to make $1 million by trading a little bit of money, okay? So I think those things have to be said. But the very, very smallest, most absolute basic good strategy that you can trade. I'm not talking about buying and selling calls, which are, you know, in sometimes many cases, lottery tickets where you're just purely speculating and gambling. But the very most basic trade, like a spread trade where you're selling a spread or taking in a credit spread and you're trying to derive some income, trading it with a high probability of success, that type of trade on its most bare bones basic level can be traded for roughly $70, $60 of risk. So when people ask me all the time, and we get this question all the time, so I give you multiple answers to this. How much money do I need to start options trading? Well, you could make your very first trade with 50, or let's not even call it 50. Let's call it $60 or $70 of risk. Okay, that could be a one lot credit spread trade with a high probability of success. Now, you're probably not going to quit your job and ride off into the sunset on the income that comes from those types of trades, because you might make $10, $20, depending on how you exit the trade. You're not going to kill it with those. But could you do it? Yes. So from a very, very practical standpoint, or I guess a very literal standpoint, $70, $60 is what you would need to start trading a one lot strategy. Now, the more complicated question is really like how much should you have when you start trading? Now, I've given this range for a long time and there's some math and logic behind it. And I'm not going to go through all the math and logic behind it on this podcast because I've covered it in other shows and we'll link those into the show notes page on why you should start with this amount of money. But I believe personally, this is me, I believe personally that you should start at the bare minimum options trading with somewhere around $5,000. Now, I know for some people, they say, well, I can start with $3,000. Great. I think you could start with $3,000. Do I think it's a great idea to start with $3,000? I don't. I think that you could start and give yourself a better leg up and a better opportunity of reaching success with about $5,000. That gives you the ability to keep some of that money in cash, which I'm a fan of. Usually, I suggest around half of your portfolio stays in cash. And then use the other half to make a lot of diversified and uncorrelated trades in different securities and try to spread your risk across different things. So to kind of sort of relate it back to the Arby's coupon, don't just trade one Arby's coupon and think you're going to make $1 million. You probably want to trade coupons all over the place in different products, Wendy's, McDonald's, Arby's, Chipotle, whatever, right? And by the way, I'm not suggesting you trade food coupons, but you get the picture. But this ability to use $5,000 gives you a lot more flexibility so that your position sizes are small, so that you can get into a lot of trades, so you can start to let the power of probabilities and math work in your favor. So when people ask, well, how much money do I need to start trading options, Kirk? Well, I say, well, you could do it with $60 or $70 and do one trade. And then you would just wait and see how that trade goes. And hopefully you don't blow your $60 or $70 portfolio up. But you get a better shot of success, I believe, if you just math-based and just numbers-based, if you start with around $5,000. Could you do less? Yes, you could do less. But I say get $5,000. That'll give you a good go. If you're smart about it, use some automated trading tech. You don't do stupid things, emotional things. I think you give yourself a good shot. Okay, question number three. How do I select the best options trading strategy? And I was like, oh my God, ChatGPT, come on, you're killing me here. Like these are really good questions. Not only because they're good questions, because these are questions people ask, but they're also hard to explain. So here's my explanation for this one. The best options trading strategy is the one that works for you. And you're like, I know, Kirk, that's the canned response, but it is true. I know for a fact that some strategies work better for other types of traders. And it's just the reality. It's like asking like what food is the best food to eat, right? There is no best food to eat. There's the best food for you, right? Like some people believe that the best food for them is XYZ, whatever it is. Other people say, no, the best food for me and my body type and the type of food, maybe my allergies or the things I'm allergic to is ABCDEFG, right? There's no possible way, and this is like the rational, should be your rational side as an investor trader. There is no possible way on earth that there is one strategy that is the best strategy for all traders. You can have strategies that make money in up markets, strategies that make money in down markets, strategies that make money in sideways markets, strategies that make money that take a long time to mature and are more conservative, strategies that are a little bit more volatile and shorter in duration and time. They trade a lot quicker and people like those strategies better. The best strategy is the strategy that fits your risk profile. Like what type of person and trader are you? Do you like seeing your account go up and down 10% per day? Some people do. And I'm not one of those people, but some traders do. Some traders are completely comfortable with lots of risk in a short period of time and going for it, like going for big hits, big home runs. I personally am not that type of person, right? So I'm not comfortable with that. Does that mean that those strategies don't work? No, it just means that you have to accept the risk associated with those strategies. And so the best strategy is really the one that fits your risk profile. Now, that all being said, I believe, this is just me, it's not a recommendation, not an endorsement, not a suggestion. I believe that generally credit spread type strategies, so bull put spreads, bear call spreads, iron condors, iron butterflies, are some of the best strategies that you can trade. not only because they're defined to risk, which means that I know exactly how much I can make, I know exactly how much I can lose, but they also are strategies that help you control your risk so that you can trade more products and more occurrences. You could do more legging into it. It just gives you more optionality long-term in what you do. And so I like those a lot. That's why they're the main strategies on Option Alpha, is because we really believe in these. We think that credit spreads and those types of strategies and spread type trading is the type of trading that most people should be doing. That doesn't mean that you can't do strategies that are undefined risks like straddles and strangles. I just don't think that they're great for beginners. I don't think they're even great for people who have been trading a while. I think that they're great for a defined niche of people who really understand the risk associated with those and can manage that risk. And that is not everybody. So that's a really bizarre answer, hopefully, but I hope you understand that the best strategy is the one that suits you. Now, here's a couple tools to start exploring strategies. One, you should just start trading and start figuring out like what kind of fits your personality. Once you start making some trades, just do paper trading at first. You'll find that you gravitate naturally towards a type of strategy or a type of setup or a system and go into that system because it's fine, because there's things that work short-term, long-term, up, down, sideways, left, right, whatever. Do a lot of testing. Do some back testing. Do some research. See what works. Don't just blindly guess, right? If you like a certain type of strategy, hone in on that by doing some research and some back testing to see exactly what works. So this is very, you know, similar in, you could say food, you could say real estate, you could say anything. You know, if you like a certain type of food group, right? And you're like, the best food group for me is salads. Okay, well, what type of salad? What are the ingredients? What are the dressings that work best for you, right? That's what you do. You kind of select a food group, if you will, a target, and then you hone in on that. You do some testing. Well, what works best for iron condors, or what works best for neutral trading strategies? That's what you need to do, is spend your time doing that. That's actually where you get the most value and benefit anyway. Okay, question number four. What are the key components of an options contract? Okay, this one's a really fun one because this gives you a really good understanding of what the main components of an options contract are. And now we'll start to use, I would say, like, we'll get away from the coupon, the Arby's analogy example, and I'll start really talking about like actual contracts that you would trade for particular tickers, okay? There are three main components of an option contract. The first main component of an option contract is the underlying security. Now, that is arguably the most important because that is where the option contract derives. That's why they call it a derivative. That's where the option contract gets their value, from the movement or not movement of that underlying security. So if I'm going to trade options, what am I going to trade options on? And you'll hear people say this a lot when they say like, well, I'm trading options on, or I have a position in whatever. So in this case, let's use Apple. So if I want to trade options on Apple, which is ticker symbol AAPL, then that is going to be the first main component of determining the value of the option contract, is what ticker symbol is it trading on. This would be different than if I was trading options on Google or on Tesla or Nvidia or on SPY, which is the broad market. So what are you trading on? That's the first thing. The second main component of an option contract is the strike price. This is the price at which you are, again, striking a deal with the other party. Now we'll talk about calls and puts here in a second, but this is the price at which you're striking a price with the other party. This is that other major component. I am trading options on Apple, and I have an option contract that has whatever the price of Apple is. You know, I will have an option contract that is at a strike price of 200, right? Now, Apple could be trading below 200, above 200, right at 200, but it doesn't matter because the strike price of the option contract says that I'm going to buy or sell stock. And again, we'll get to that component of it here in a second with calls and puts, but I'm going to buy or sell that underlying security, which is Apple, at 200. So that is the second component of the option contract, is the strike price. The third component of an option contract is the expiration date. There has to be a date at which this contract, this side agreement that I'm making with somebody else, dies or expires. We call this the expiration date. There are lots of expiration dates. some securities like Apple and SPY and Tesla, they have expiration dates that go every other day or every 2 days, or sometimes every single day, there's a new series of contracts that are available to trade or expire. Some options or some securities that you're trading, if they don't have a lot of liquidity, there's not a lot of interest, those option contracts might go in different series that expire every month. Some have series that expire every week, every day, etc. So there's a lot of options, no pun intended, in the different expiration dates you can choose, again, based on the underlying security that you're trading. So to recap real quick, the main components of an options contract are the underlying security that you're trading, the ticker symbol, the strike price, and the expiration date. Okay. Now, the next question is, what is the difference? And this is a question number 5 from ChatGPT. What is the difference between a call option and a put option? Now, this is a great natural next question because I talked about in everything we discussed so far that an options contract gives you the choice to buy or sell the underlying asset. Well, the difference between a call option and a put option is where we actually make that differentiation between are we choosing to buy the right to buy the asset or choosing to get an option to sell the asset. And that is the main difference. So let's go through both of these. And here's the cool thing is like these combinations of things you can put together are where options trading gets very fascinating, very intriguing. So if you dive into it, you'll see this too. But a call option, when you buy a call option, which is just a type of option contract, and by the way, there's only two types. There are either call options or put options. Okay, so you have all option contracts and they're divided into call options and put options. And it's based on whether you're going to buy the underlying asset or sell the underlying asset. That's the choice you're getting. A call option gives the buyer, so whoever the buyer is in that trade, the right, which is the choice. This is really key, so I'm going to go through this slowly. It gives the buyer the right, so they have a choice, but not the obligation. And that's really important. If you're the option buyer, you are buying a choice. You are buying the option to do something. That does not mean that you are forced to do it. To quickly go back to our, I know I said I wouldn't talk about the Arby's coupon example, but in the coupon example, if you have a coupon, you are not forced to exercise that coupon. Nobody is telling you, you got to go into Arby's and you have to give them this coupon and you have to buy the roast beef sandwich combo. It doesn't work like that. And in the regular options market, it doesn't work like that either for option buyers. If you are the option buyer, you are buying a choice. Now that choice comes with some price, right? You got to pay something to get a choice, but you have the right, but not the obligation to buy that underlying security at that price on or before expiration. So again, with a call option, you are buying the right to buy an asset. That's it. A call option gives you the right, but not the obligation, to buy an asset at the strike price on or before expiration. Pure and simple. So for example, if I was a buyer of a call option and it gave me the right to buy shares of some company at $100, that company stock could currently be trading at $95. Now, am I going to exercise my right to buy stock in that company at $100 a share? No, because the company's stock is currently trading for $95. There's no need for me to exercise and deliver my coupon to somebody else and say, hey, I want to buy stock in this company at $100. But if I buy that call option, I have the choice to buy that stock at $100 a share. So let's say now the company stock goes from 95 up to 105, right? The actual market changes. The company's stock goes from 95 to 105. Well, I still have my call option. I'm holding on to it like you're holding on to your Arby's coupon. And now the stock price is at 105. So now I have the choice because I bought this call option. It gave me the choice, right? I could now go to the other person on the other side and say, hey, look, here's my option contract, my call option contract. It says right here that I have the choice to buy shares at $100. The company is trading at 105, so I am exercising my choice to buy that stock at $100 when the stock is openly trading in the market for $105. And then I can, again, generate a little bit of a profit. So a call option, again, gives you that choice. You buy that right from somebody else. Now, as you'll learn later, that right is not free. No one's just like, hey, let me just give you a bunch of call options, right? There's nobody walking around going, hey, would you like this amazing call option that gives you the choice to buy a company shares in the future if you want to, and it doesn't cost you anything, we're just going to hand it to you? No, of course not. You have to pay for that right. This is what I love about trading in general, so I'll just dovetail on this for a second, but it's so cool because there's really no free lunch in doing this. There's not. Because you have to pay for this right. If you want this awesome call option, because I know you're thinking right now, if you've never heard of options contracts or trading before, you're like, oh my God, that's amazing. But if you've never heard of it, right, you're thinking, how does this even exist, right? Like, this is, it's like a license to print money. But you have to buy that option contract. You have to exchange value with somebody else because somebody else is not going to just give that to you. So a call option, again, gives the buyer, which in this case, I'm using myself as the buyer, the right, but not the obligation. Now, what does that mean? It means that I don't have to exercise that option contract. Like we talked about before, if the company, let's say the company's stock, when we bought the option contract was at 95, and later the company's stock goes crashing down. Well, do I have to buy shares at 100? No, I bought the choice, which means I don't ever have to exercise my right. I can let that coupon, that option contract, just expire, just evaporate into thin air, right? Now, did I lose a little bit of money buying that option contract? Sure. Maybe I paid $2 to get into that option contract. So I lost $2, but I didn't lose the value of buying the stock at 95 and seeing it crash. And so that is the value that an option buyer has when they buy these contracts, is they're willing to outlay a little bit of money to acquire the right to do something in the future, but they need the underlying asset to move. They need to be right in their assumption. And they got to be right in the timing of that assumption. The underlying stock moves too late, beyond the expiration date, too bad, right? The contract expires. It's like your coupon. There's an expiration date to your coupon. Now let's quickly talk about a put option, and then we'll talk about the other side. A put option is the same mechanically as a call option, except the only difference in a put option is that you are buying the right to sell the stock or an asset at the specific price. Now, I know this one trips up a lot of people, but it really shouldn't because you're overthinking it. The call option, if you're an option buyer, gives you the right to buy an underlying stock or asset at a specific price. A put option gives you the right to sell it at a specific price. Now, why would you want to do this? Well, if you believe that there's value in defining where you would sell an asset, like the value of it, you don't think it's going to go any higher than X, or you think it could go really, really far below Y, you might want to use a put option. So if I'm a put option buyer, I am buying the right, and again, but not the obligation, so I'm buying a choice to sell an asset at a specific price on or before a specific date. So for example, if I buy a put option that gives me the right to sell shares of a company at $100 a share, let's say the stock is currently trading at $105, it doesn't make sense for me to exercise that put option, right? All I did was acquire the choice to sell shares at $100. But if I really wanted to sell shares, let's say I own shares of this stock, then I would just sell them at $105, right? They're trading in the open market for $105. Why would I go through the process of selling shares for $100 and exercising my put option when I could just openly sell the shares for $105? So you can see how call options and put options work the same, just in complete inverse of one another for direction and what makes sense. Now, let's say, however, that the stock price starts to tank, like go down really, really far. Let's say the stock price drops from $105 down to, let's say, $80. Well, in that case, I've already essentially pre-sold my stock for $100 a share. Because the other person on the other side, they took that deal, that side agreement. They said that I could sell them shares at $100. That was the strike price of our option contract. And let's say the stock started tanking. Well, I've already pre-sold those shares for $100 a share. So I don't participate in any of the downside below $100 a share. Now, this is really cool because this again is this, you can see how this transfer of risk can start to happen between different parties who are trading these option contracts and how the value of this option contract can change based on how the underlying asset trades. My put option is not worth anything if the stock is trading at $105. There's no reason for me to exercise that put option. Therefore, it probably has very little value when it gets to expiration. But if the stock is tanking, well, this put option is very valuable. It potentially balloons in value because as the stock goes down, the value of the thing I'm holding that promises that I can sell the shares at $100 a share continues to go up as the stock goes down. So that's where you get this derivative value that moves with the underlying shares. Now, again, just like a call option, nobody's walking around out there saying, hey, you want a put option? You want this like unlimited downside protection below a certain price? They're not just handing these out like playing cards. Of course not. You have to buy that protection. Now, here's the example I will use for put options to help you understand how put options work, because I think it really helps. Because again, just like the Arby's coupon, I hope helped with the call option side. Put options, you're already using them all over the place. I guarantee if you're listening to this podcast, you have a put option right now. You just don't know what it's called. It's called something different. It's called insurance. Insurance is a put option. That's all insurance is. Think about your insurance on your car or your house, right? You buy insurance, do you not? Right? No, the insurance companies, as far as I know, they don't walk around, they say, hey, guess what? You've got insurance. You know, they're not Oprah. No, you've got insurance, and you've got insurance, and you've got insurance. No. You have to buy insurance. You have to go to an insurance company and say, I would like to get insurance. And then they say, okay, your insurance is X cost, right? Because we are covering you for this time period, right? Doesn't your insurance contract that you have with a company, let's say you're buying insurance for your car insurance usually goes in 6 months or year timeframes. They say, hey, I'm not going to cover you for your whole life, but for $100 or whatever, I'll cover you for the next 6 months or the next year. That's an option contract. Do you see that? You are paying money to buy a put option because what you're doing is you're trying to protect the asset that you have, your car, your house, whatever. You're trying to protect it in case that asset disappears or gets damaged considerably. So let's use your house as an example. You have this house, you have this home, right? And you buy insurance in case the house burns down. Now, if the house is worth, and I'll just use regular round numbers so it makes sense, okay, no houses are worth this, but let's say the house is worth $100, you could buy insurance that starts kicking in at $80. So maybe you say to the insurance company, look, I want to buy insurance. If there's a little bit of damage, maybe there's a storm or something like that, I'll cover the damage. But what I really want to protect is I want to protect in case the house literally burns to the ground. And if it burns to the ground, I need $80 to rebuild or move or go to a different house. So you buy insurance at $80. You buy a put option from the insurance company at a strike price of $80. And so if the house burns to the ground, which is the underlying asset, this is the thing that the insurance contract sits on top of, right? That insurance contract is tied to that house, not tied to anybody else's house, it's tied to yours. If the house burns to the ground, then the insurance company pays you the full value, $80, right? Because you've already pre-sold your house to the insurance company for $80. Do you guys understand that? How crazy that is? That you're already using insurance contracts as put options? You are pre-selling the security, the underlying asset, to somebody else for a specific price. Now, if the house burns down, guess what? You already sold your house, essentially sold your house in a way to the insurance company for $80. They are legally obligated to buy that asset from you, or not buy that asset from you, but pay you right? Yeah, buy that asset from you for $80. Now, does insurance, again, is insurance free? No, you probably had to pay a little bit of money. But are you going to exercise your insurance contract if your house doesn't burn down? No, right? So just like if a stock in a put option scenario, if you buy a put option for $100 at a strike price of $100 and the stock is trading at $105, it doesn't make sense to exercise that right. You're not going to go to somebody and say, hey, sell me the shares for $100, right? Because you could sell it yourself for $105. And the same thing happens with your insurance on your house. If the value of your house goes up and you want to sell your house, well, you just sell your house to somebody else. You don't go to your insurance company and say, hey, look, the value went up. I'd like to sell my house for $80 when the value is $120, right? Nobody would really do that. And nobody does that because it's not part of what a put option contract is. But a put option contract, again, gives you the buyer, the person that's entering this insurance agreement. You have the right, but not the obligation to sell that asset at that specific price. So just like insurance is your, it's essentially your choice. You can choose to exercise your insurance or not. Just like you, in many cases, and people know this, you choose to file a claim with your insurance company or not. Filing a claim is essentially exercising your right as a put option contract buyer. And the person on the other, the company on the other end, they are the one that has to exercise that claim, that has to take that claim seriously, right? In the case of put option contracts, they're obligated to do the assignment. They're obligated to buy the security at that price. So hopefully this helps out. Again, you already use option contracts all the time. If you've ever used a coupon, you're using call options. If you've ever bought insurance or have insurance, you're already using put options. And the value of those changes as the house value changes or as the time changes, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Now, what's the difference? Here's question number six. Man, we have this already really long podcast, but I hope you guys enjoyed. I'm enjoying doing this one with you. If you did, please let us know. Give us a rating or a review. Question number six, what's the difference between buying and selling a contract? Now, I did put this one in order a little bit here in the middle of the pack for questions from ChatGPT, but that was a legit question that ChatGPT had. And I just ordered it in a way that made sense for our conversation here because the next logical question that ties to this, all discussion of like put options and call options is, well, what's the difference between being an option buyer and being an option seller? So clearly there's two sides to every trade. You can't buy something unless somebody else sells it to you, and you can't sell an asset unless somebody else is guaranteed to buy that asset. There has to be two parties to every trade. You have to have some counterparty on the other side that's willing to exchange the risk with you. Now, the difference between buying and selling the options contracts is purely the exchange of risk. And the exchange of risk is one-to-one on every side. And what I mean by that is that everything you get as an option buyer, you give up when you become an option seller. And everything that you give up as an option buyer, you get when you become an option seller. And this works in both directions. Let's use the put options as an example, and then we'll go back to the call options if that works for you. And the reason I want to use the put options is because we're talking about insurance. It's the most logical thing to use as the example. So again, in our example that we just went through, if I am the option buyer and I'm buying insurance in case my house burns down, somebody is selling me that insurance. Do you guys agree? Right? I don't just go magically into the ether of the world and say, universe, please sell me insurance. No, somebody else is willing to accept that risk. And it is an assumption of risk because I, as the option buyer, as the insurance contract buyer, I am buying insurance from somebody else. And that other person is, in this case, the put option seller. They are accepting risk that if the house burns down, they're going to pay out the money that we agreed on, the $80 strike price. They're going to assume all that risk, right? Now, just like an option buyer buys the right, but not the obligation to convert that option contract, the exact opposite right is given up by the option seller. Remember I said things happen in inverse one-to-one. The option buyer has a right. If the option buyer has a choice, the option seller does not have a choice. And so every option seller has an obligation to exercise and assign that contract if the option buyer chooses. So every option seller, call options and put options, They have an obligation. They actually don't have a choice when it comes to the exercise or assignment of that contract. Now, that says nothing right now about the ability to trade that contract in and out. So just so you know, before you get too scared, because I know some people are like, whoa, 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 I'd never want to be an option seller. That doesn't mean you can't trade that contract with somebody else. I could sell an option contract and later I could buy it back at a cheaper price. Maybe the value goes down and I buy it back and sell it to somebody else and I get out of the position, okay? So that's where most of the options trading happens. But when it comes down to the actual real logistics of exercise and assignment and choosing to convert from the contract to the underlying security or payout, then an option seller is obligated. Just like an insurance company, if they give you an insurance contract, they sell you an insurance contract that says, look, if your house burns down, we're going to give you $80, right? In our example, okay? If your house burns down, they got to give you $80. That's it. That's their obligation, right? They don't have a choice, right? They're kind of at your discretion because they gave up that right when they gave you the right, right? They sold the right to you. You bought the right because that was valuable and they sold you the right. Now, as an option seller, that insurance company, they are not, and one thing is insurance companies are not stupid. They're not going to give you some right, some choice without getting something in return. So the insurance company doesn't give you this insurance contract and say, here you go, here's your insurance contract, and they assume all this risk. No, you had to pay them a premium. You had to pay them some monetary value in order to get this right that you were after. You wanted something, you wanted the right to have insurance, and you wanted to transfer essentially your risk to the insurance company, because that's what you're doing. You're saying, look, I don't want the risk that the house burns down and I lose all my money. So please, Mr. and Mrs. Insurance Company, please accept this risk. I want to transfer the risk to you. The insurance company says, look, I'll do it. Don't twist my arm on here. I'll do it. But in order for me to do it, you got to pay me some money right now to accept this risk for the next year. And that is the option premium that gets traded back and forth between the option buyer and the option seller. So that risk might be, the insurance contract might be $100 every year, right? That's what your insurance is. Or for your car, maybe it's $50 a month, right? But every single month, the insurance company is collecting a premium in order to assume the risk that you are giving them. Maybe they collect it monthly, every 6 months, every year, whatever. For the insurance company, that's how they make money. They make money by collecting that income. And if they're good, making sure that they're doing their due diligence and their research to make sure that houses don't burn down too often or too fast or in succession enough that they have to pay out more money than they collect in premiums. And that's why insurance companies make a crap ton of money all the time anyway, because they're really good at math and probabilities around this. By the way, if you've never listened to the podcast where I talk about this with Warren Buffett, there is a reason why Warren Buffett is arguably the biggest option seller on the planet because of all of his exposure to insurance. He actually talks about options trading in the same vein as insurance right in his 10Ks and 10Qs for Berkshire Hathaway. It's crazy. But why do you think Buffett is such a fan of insurance? It's because he understands the math around transferring risk, selling insurance, selling options to somebody else in exchange for income now. And that's a really fascinating idea. I don't want to dovetail too much on that. But hopefully you understand the difference between a put option buyer in this case and a put option seller is that they're exchanging risk and everything is one-to-one. The buyer gets a right. The seller has an obligation. The buyer gives up cash. That cash goes directly to the option seller. That is the premium to enter the deal. If the house burns down, the insurance company pays out $80. The option seller pays out $80. The option buyer collects $80. Everything is a one-to-one transfer of risk between the parties, back and forth, right? If someone gives up something, it goes to the other person. If someone acquires something, a right, an obligation, or whatever, it transfers in the inverse to the other person. Okay, let's look at an example now of call options. So back to our example of call options, you remember what they were? A call option gives you the right to buy stock at a certain price on or before a specific date. So a call option seller then, someone who is willing to sell a call option, is obligated to sell their call option, or they're obligated to sell the asset at a specific price if the buyer chooses. So the call option seller does not have a choice. If the buyer comes and says, look, I am exercising my agreement, I am going to buy this stock at this price. If you are that call option seller on the other side, you have to sell them the stock at that price if they choose to exercise the contract. So for example, if a buyer, a call option buyer, owns a call option that gives them the right to buy shares at $100 and the company's stock is trading at $105, the option seller would be obligated to sell shares to that person still at $100, right? It's a put option just completely in reverse. So they have to sell shares to that person for $100, which means if they have their own shares that they're giving up, maybe I have my own shares and I say, look, I'm willing to sell you my shares for $100. They lose the opportunity to sell them in the open market for $105. So they've lost a little bit of money, but they're still selling the shares because they're obligated to sell the shares to the call option buyer at $100. If the call option seller does not own the shares, and this is where you talk about strategies where they call it like undefined risk, right? Where you don't have covered risk. But let's say I'm just speculating on this and I choose to sell a call option because I want to collect some income, whatever. And let's say the stock is trading at 105. Well, I've got to go buy shares at 105 in order to deliver these shares to the call option buyer for $100, which means I lose $5 trying to fulfill my obligation, right? The analogy here that I use for a call option seller, and I think this is a good analogy because I think it makes sense for a lot of people. If it doesn't work, you let me know. But a call option seller is essentially a home builder. That's what they are. They're a home builder, right? And every home builder, when they enter into a contract with somebody, they say, look, I'm going to build you a home and I'm going to charge you, let's call it $200,000 to build this home, right? And that's the agreement they sign. And the call option buyer in this case is the homeowner. The homeowner says, yes, Mr. Builder, I will enter into this agreement that you will build my home and I will pay you $200,000. But I want a completed home, right? Like I'm not entering into an agreement for a half-built home. I want a fully built home with everything that we agreed on for $200,000. Okay, great. So the call option buyer now has a defined price at which they are going to buy this asset, this home from the home builder, right? Now the home builder, let's say he's building the house and let's say costs start going up and now lumber is more expensive and plumbing and electrical and all these things are a little bit more expensive than he thought. He is still obligated to deliver a house for a price of $200,000. Now it might have cost him because he hasn't delivered the house yet. And this is the example of a call option seller, but they may not have the asset yet. He doesn't have the asset. When you enter into a contract with a home builder, they don't have the house built. If they had the house built, they would sell you the house for exactly what it cost them plus their profit to build the house. But if they're building a house for you, they haven't built the house yet. They don't own the underlying shares yet. So he would have to build the house. And if the house costs, let's say, $12,000 to build. I don't know where that number came from, but let's say it costs $212,000 to build the house with all the additional expenses. He still has to sell you the house for $200,000 because that was the strike price of your deal. He is the option seller. He is selling you this asset. He's fixed the selling price at $200,000. But now the open market, the value or cost of actually building that house was $212,000. So he lost $12,000 on that deal. He built you a house, cost him more than what he thought. And so now he's got to still only collect $200,000 from you. So that is how a call option buyer and call option seller work. A call option seller is just purely obligated to sell the asset at your strike price. They might already own the asset, in which case they just deliver it to you. That's called a covered. They're covered, right? They already own it, so they're covered. They've got the asset. But if they're uncovered, that means that they don't already have the asset. And it's easy for them to just go out in the open market and buy it and then deliver the asset to you. In this case, they would buy the shares at whatever the shares are trading at, and they'd be obligated to deliver the shares to you, and they would lose the difference between that. Now, again, just like an option seller for a put option is going to collect your insurance premium, a call option seller is also going to collect a premium from you in order to enter into this agreement. So if you are a call option buyer and you tell your builder, right, you're trying to build a house and you're a call option buyer and you say, look, Mr. Builder, I want to buy this house, but I need it done in the next year, hint, hint, expiration date. I need it done in the next year and I want to pay only $200,000. I'm not going to pay a penny over $200,000. Now your builder, the call option seller, would say in this case, well, listen, that's a lot of risk for me because I, you know, lumber prices are crazy, plumbing prices are crazy, market's crazy, gas goes up and down. I don't know. I don't know if I could do it for $200,000, right? But if you want me to, if you want me to enter this agreement and take your risk, right, which is what they're doing, they're taking your risk because you don't want the risk of paying more than $200,000. They say, okay, I'll take your risk. I'll take on your risk, which is the transfer of risk. But in order to do this, in order to enter into this agreement where I build you a house and you only pay me $200,000, it's going to cost you an upfront cost of $5,000. That's the premium. That's the premium in order to transfer the risk back and forth. And so now that builder has that premium that kind of pads their numbers. So let's say now that they build the house for exactly $200,000. Well, great. You get the house for $200,000. You paid $200,000 plus $5,000 of the initial option contract premium to the builder. The builder collects what? They collect the exact opposite of what you paid them, which is they collect $5,000 upfront plus $200,000 when the house is done, right? And that offsets the cost that they had of $200,000, right? So now you basically are going, the builder has a $5,000 profit, their premium that they baked into the contract. So that difference, that transfer of risk is pretty clearly evident when you look at call options in the vein of home buying and building houses. And in the case of put options, you look at them in the vein of buying insurance on those already then built houses. So hopefully that makes sense. But again, a call option seller is obligated to sell the asset at that strike price if the buyer chooses before expiration. Now, one thing that we didn't talk about here is that, and this is an important concept, so I want to hit on it first, is that all of this assumes things happen at or near the expiration of these contracts. The vast majority of options trading doesn't get to that point. And the reason is because if I have a contract that if I have an option contract, whether I'm a buyer or seller, I can trade out of that contract when the value changes to another option buyer or seller. So let's say that I buy a call option contract and now the stock goes up really, really high, right? The value of the stock goes up crazy. That option contract that I bought, well, it's way more valuable now. It might be more valuable for me to just sell that contract to somebody else who's going to start the process all over again from their vantage point at the new price and level, right? So I could sell that contract to somebody else and just reverse the trade. And so that's a really key component of options trading is that most of the trades that occur never get to the point of physically transforming or converting into the underlying security. Now, it happens. It's going to happen to you for sure, and it's easy to handle. It's not life-threatening. But most of options trading is the trading of these contracts back and forth in the open market, right? And it's not actually converting them over into their physical underlying buying or selling of the shares. But it is important to understand, which is why I take the time to describe the underlying shares so much, and I think it's so valuable to do that, because if you don't understand the underlying mechanics of it, like the real meat and potatoes of how option contracts work, when it gets to the exercise and assignment point, then you really won't understand anything else beyond that, because that is the core fundamental like value, intrinsic value of these contracts. They get derived from the actual implementation of them when they get to expiration. Even if they don't get there, you can trade in and out of these contracts all you want, but you need to know how this stuff works. Okay. Question number 7. How do I determine? So we've talked about all this buying and selling, calls and puts, whatever. How do I determine the strike price of an options contract? So if you're looking at all this, and I've just thrown out numbers like call options at 105 and call options at 100 and puts at 80. Well, how do I determine the strike price that I want to use? Now, again, like the question that was asked by ChatGPT about, you know, or I guess that people ask and ChatGPT found on what the best strategy is, the best strike price is very, very flexible in the sense that you just understand that different strike prices have different values associated with them. It is determined which strike price is best for you based on how much risk you are willing to accept and how much money you're willing to pay or collect. So it always gets back down to this assumption of risk, this transfer of risk back and forth. Let's use the insurance company analogy to help us walk through this. If I am going to buy insurance from an insurance company, let's say Warren Buffett's insurance companies, Geico, right? I want to buy insurance on my car. If I have a car that's worth $5,000, which those apparently don't exist anymore in the universe, but let's say I did. If I had a car that was worth $5,000 and I wanted to buy insurance and I want to buy insurance at $5,000 of value. So the strike price was at the same price as the value of the car. Well, Geico might charge me, let's say, $200 a year for that contract because they got to cover the risk that the car gets totaled and they have to pay me $5,000. So they charge me $200 a year. But if I assume more of the risk and I move my strike price down to $4,000, that means that I'm assuming about $1,000 of risk. And if the car gets totaled, I only get $4,000 for a $5,000 car. But what I've done there is I've transferred the risk from Geico to myself. I've assumed more of the risk. And so as a result, let's say Geico says, hey, look, if you strike a price that's at $4,000, that's the price at which we'd pay you if the car gets totaled, then your premium, the cost to buy that insurance, goes down from $200 to $150. So I've saved $50. Now, I saved $50, but I also took on $1,000 of risk. Is that a good trade? I don't know. I'm just using round numbers. But that shows you how the strike price will help determine the value of the contract that it's actually being traded on. If I move down my strike price, in the case of a put option, the premium goes down as well. If I move up my price of a call option, my strike price of a call option, the premium of that goes down in inverse because call options and put options are inverse. So let's use a call option example here and continue to unpack this. If I buy a call option and the stock is trading at 100 and I buy a call option at 105, right? The stock is trading at 100 and I buy a call option with a strike price of 105, the option buyer might charge me $2 for that call option, or the option seller might charge me $2 for that call option. Because guess what? There's a pretty good chance that if the stock is trading at $100, that it could, in the next however long this contract is, let's say it's for 6 months, that it could trade above 105. So the option seller is like, hey, look, there's a pretty good chance that this happens here. And if it trades above 105, I'm up the creek. So I need to collect a pretty good premium here to accept this risk. But let's say I change it. I say, look, call option seller, let's move our strike price. Let me choose a different strike price. Instead of a strike price at 105, let me choose a strike price at 110. So now I only really make money if the stock moves from 100 to 110 or above. So now that's a whole different game, essentially, right? Now I've transferred more risk to myself. So the call option seller says, look, you've transferred more risk to yourself. I'm willing to accept now just a dollar instead of $2 for that trade. And so now you can see how the assumption of risk and the transfer of risk is used and inversely related to the premium that you would accept or collect for those contracts. So to get back to the question that ChatGPT asked, how do you determine the strike price of an option contract? Well, it's a little bit of like, how much risk do you want to transfer and how much risk do you want to take on? If you're an option seller, do you want to sell options close to where the security is trading and collect a lot of money up front, but have a lot more risk that if things go wrong, maybe it doesn't work out? You sell options too far away from where the security is, there's not enough premium to really collect because it's so far, there's a low probability that the stock ever gets to those farther extremes. So you don't really collect a lot of money doing that. That'd be like an insurance company selling you insurance for $1,000 of, like, if the house, if your $200,000 house burns down, they're like, hey, we'll sell you $1,000 of insurance. Well, how valuable is that insurance? If I have a $200,000 house, if it burns down, I really don't care about the $1,000. Like, it doesn't really protect me. So maybe I pay a buck for that, like literally a dollar for that insurance. It's not valuable. So the insurance company, you go too far out and there's no value in those contracts. So that doesn't mean that there's some sweet spot in the middle or not some sweet spot in the middle, but just that you understand that option premiums and contracts, as they go further from where the security is trading, they become less valuable on either side. And that's the, for call options, they become less valuable the further up, and for put options, they become less valuable the further down that you go. And so there's this beautiful, and I think it's beautiful, this beautiful like yin and yang that happens in these markets where you, the more risk you take on, or the higher probability of success you take on, or the lower your probability of success, all these levers that change would determine the strike prices that you use. Now, good for you, inside of Option Alpha, we give you lots of tools that help you determine these probabilities and the value of your trades, et cetera. But it's just safe to say that there's no perfect strike price for a contract. It just really depends on how much risk you're willing to take or transfer or get, or how much optionality you want to buy in entering any contracts. Okay. Number eight. Now, this one I think is where ChatGPT started to, I don't know, it started to really change the game just a little bit and started to shift some of the conversation here around basics, which I don't think everything that we went through is like super basic, but I do hope it really helps out in kind of understanding where we get to this point. But number eight's question was, what is implied volatility and how does it impact options trading? And I was like, oh my gosh, I see this one again. And I'm like, all right, ChatGPT, let's buckle up here and let's get some of these traders through this and let's educate a new generation of traders here. But this is an important concept and is an important question because we haven't really covered this at all in any discussion that we've had. So far in trading, or talking about options contracts and trading contracts, we've talked a little bit about the value of contracts with different expiration dates, right? If a contract has an expiration date that's 2 years from now, by default, call option or put option, that contract is more valuable. It costs more money to get into that contract because it doesn't expire for a really, really long time. So by default, that contract is worth more than a contract that expires sooner or doesn't have a long expiration date. But there's this other component of options trading that we have to include in the price of these contracts because there is some, and I don't know how best to describe it, but for most people, it's this opportunity cost that has to be baked in, essentially. So if you are trading a contract on a stock that's trading $100 right now, underlying shares are $100 a share, you want to ask yourself, well, does that stock always trade at around $100? Does the average movement of that security, it's like, does it go up or down by a couple pennies a day? Like, how volatile is this thing that I'm about to trade contracts on? And the reason that this is important, this volatility aspect of the underlying security, is because you need to know as an option buyer or seller how volatile. If I'm a call option seller and somebody says, hey, I'm going to buy a call option from you for $105, the stock is trading at $100. Well, if that stock is not that volatile, like maybe it trades up or down a little bit every day, well, maybe I'm more willing to accept that risk. Because I know that, hey, I'm not likely to get hit, right? Like, I'm not likely that the stock is going to go up to 105 because it generally doesn't do that, right? Or maybe historically hasn't done that. But let's say I'm looking at a different security, still trading at $100, but that security that's currently trading at $100 might go up or down by $80 a day. I'm just using a really extreme example here, but to prove the point, let's say that literally it could be at 180 or 20 tomorrow. And then the next day, it's back to 100 or back to 260. I mean, it just goes crazy. It has a lot of volatility. Well, that option contract, I would want a lot more money for as an option seller, because if I'm going to sell a $105 call option to somebody else, and that underlying stock, I expect to have these huge movements, then there's a pretty good chance that my contract I'm selling them is going to get hit. It's going to move, or I'm going to be underwater on this contract. So I'm going to charge a lot of money up front because I don't know what's going to happen in the future. The same thing could be said for the home builder in this example. Let's say, again, the call option seller is a home builder, right? A person who's building a house. If they know that lumber prices are going crazy and gas prices are going crazy, and they expect that to happen in the future, they expect more volatility, well, they're going to ask for more money up front to enter into that contract because they have no clue where the real price is going to be when they need to physically buy lumber or when they need to buy gas for their machines to dig holes, right? They'd have no clue. So this idea that options contracts are not impacted by the expectation of volatility of the asset is completely crazy, because they are. In fact, the vast majority of an option contract's value in many cases is derived from just the expectation of how volatile the underlying stock is. Now, that expectation, that forward-looking future guess, for lack of a better word, because it is a guess, because we have no idea. And this is the beauty of options trading and markets in general, is that we always don't know what's in the future. Nobody knows. And we just guess. We all guess through our collective trading and how the markets move. We can derive assumptions about how much we all expect something to move in the future. And that expected movement is called implied volatility. And in the options world, implied volatility, the expected volatility of the stock moving forward, is a huge component of how the option contract is priced. And again, if you understand now the bare bones, meat and potatoes of what an option contract is and calls and puts and all that stuff, then of course it makes sense that if I expect the asset to be very volatile in the future, that the option contract would be more expensive, because there's unknown risk that you have to price for. And so implied volatility for option contracts, as implied volatility of the underlying security goes up, what it does is it means that call options and put options, both sides of the option chain, start to go up in value. And the reason this happens is because if we expect more volatility, that volatility can come in any form. It doesn't mean that we expect more upside volatility. It means that we expect more volatility. We expect wild price swings, and they could be in every direction, right? So implied volatility being really high, high expected volatility, means all option contracts go up in value or stay elevated. Think about a stock that's about to go through an earnings event. This is where you see it a lot. A stock that is going to announce earnings tomorrow. Let's say Apple is going to announce earnings tomorrow. Well, the implied volatility on Apple's earnings tomorrow is very high because we expect some big changes to the stock. And usually earnings events are great examples of this, because you can see the stock repricing instantly because of new information that hits the market. Now, we don't know, because we don't have insider information about what Apple's earnings are going to be. So market participants, they just know something is going to change with this company, and it's going to change really fast, because there's going to be one second where we know the information, 1 second where we don't know, and then a second later, we're going to know. We're going to know if their earnings were good or bad, if their revenue was good or bad, if their margins were good or bad or whatever, and then the stock gets repriced instantly based on the new information. And when that happens, you get the actual movement. But before the movement happens, before the announcement happens, you don't know. You don't know. Maybe there's assumptions. Analysts think, hey, the earnings are going to be this. They're going to be this. But people get surprised all the time. And so as a result, the market prices in this huge expectation of volatility. It just doesn't know which direction it's going to go. And so for that time, implied volatility on option contracts go up. And then after the earnings event, now that we know the information, okay, now we know it was good or it was bad, doesn't really matter, but now we know, then volatility comes back down. And as a result, the value of option contracts come back down because now there's known information. There's no unknown event sitting on the horizon, right? And then as time progresses and we get to the next earnings event, volatility starts to go back up again because now we're coming into an unknown event. And it's just this beautiful accordion of just volatility expansion and contraction. And so the thing to know about implied volatility and its impact on options trading is that it's fluid. It moves. It's not stagnant. Volatility and expectations of volatility move, and it's like a lungs breathing, right? Like lungs, when you breathe in, they expand, and when you breathe out, they contract. And volatility does the same thing in the market. You get these expansions of volatility and then contractions, and then expansions and then contractions. And when volatility expands, option values go up. When volatility contracts, option values go down. And so you have to now factor this in to how you're going to trade options. And that means that generally speaking, you don't want to buy options when volatility expectations are really high because you might overpay for those option contracts. That's like you don't want to buy a house when the value of lumber and everything is going crazy and the builder charges you huge extra premiums, right? Because you're like, you know, it's going to cost me more money to get this house just because the volatility of the lumber is going up, right? You don't want to do that. Instead, what you want to do is you want to generally buy options when things are low and then maybe they get crazier and, you know, values of houses go up or whatever. That's when you want to sell your house, right? And the same thing is said about options trading is that you generally want to buy, if you're going to buy, when volatility is low. And then hopefully volatility goes up and the value of contracts go up and then you can make money. And as an option seller, you generally want to sell options when volatility is high, when people are expecting huge, huge swings. That's where like you get more of your premium. And when volatility goes down, not that you want to stop selling options, but you just want to be cognizant that volatility can go back up again. I think that's also a risk that people don't account for a lot in trading, is they don't account for this expectation that's baked into contracts, which is really important. Okay, number 9, what are the risks involved in options trading? Well, geez, I know that like FINRA, the SEC, everybody, they could write a book on, and they have, on risks associated to options trading. OIC, CBOE, everybody has, there's tons of risks associated to options trading. I think in options inside of Option Alpha, not only are risk disclosures, we outline a lot of these risks associated with options trading, but then we also go through it a lot in our education. We talk about it in our courses and our videos. There is obviously risks associated with options trading, more so than we could go through here in this podcast. But here's the thing I will talk about when it comes to trading options contracts that I see as the biggest risk for people. Okay, what I would argue are some of the biggest risks. Number one is not understanding what an option contract is. So hopefully I've done a good job here today educating you on what an option contract is, the different types, how they work, etc. This is not going to be exactly how to trade them in this podcast or how we go through that process. But if you don't even understand what an option contract is, what it really is, I think that's a big risk because you don't even know the risks that you're taking on. Number two is understanding that options contracts are leveraged. They're leveraged because they're a derivative product. And with leverage comes risk. This is where all the opportunity is as well, but equally, as much as there is opportunity, there's equally a lot of risk. And so what a lot of people do is they overextend themselves all the time when trading options contracts because they don't understand the real risk of those contracts. And it comes from the fact that options contracts are leveraged bets. You're making leveraged bets, you're trading these little contracts, but they really do sit on top of serious positions if they go to expiration or get assigned. And although that doesn't happen a lot, when it does, you are now presented with the harsh reality of the leverage converting to the underlying security. And that I don't think is something that people understand enough, something we harp on a lot, we try to educate a lot, but I don't think people understand the real risks associated with that leverage. Number two or three, whatever one I'm on, is I think another risk involved in options trading is the risk of overexposure to a single ticker or single sector. One of the things that I really try to harp on, and I know a lot of people try to do as well broadly in markets, is the ability to diversify your portfolio. That doesn't stop when you start trading options. A lot of people will come in and they will trade one product, and God bless them for their ability to take on that amount of risk trading one product. But I promise you that product is going to turn and do something crazy that you've never seen before, that nobody's ever seen before, and you don't want to have all your eggs in one basket. Yes, people do a great job trading that one product, and sometimes they hit it right and they get that magic window of opportunity where everything worked out and they make a ton of money, and I am so happy for them. But I don't think that is the rule. I think that's the exception. And so when it comes to options trading, you have to diversify what you're trading. You cannot just trade your whole account in Apple or Tesla, right? You can't do it. You have to diversify, because eventually it will come back around to bite you in the butt. And when it does, you're going to be like, ah, Kirk told me on that podcast and I should have listened. So just do it now. Don't ignore this advice. Do it now. Diversify. Trade lots of different things. Trade bonds. Trade emerging markets. Trade gold. Go ahead. Trade tech. Trade whatever. Just don't trade everything in one single, like too much focus can be a killer. Okay. And so that's another thing. The other thing, other risks involved in options trading is a lot of emotional risk, a lot of human error risk. This is present in all investing generally. It's literally why we built Option Alpha, to help give you tools and resources to get away from that, to start automating things, to start removing that risk, trading more on probabilities and math. But there is a lot of risk in falling into the same pitfalls of emotional and investor biases that plague a lot of people generally on any investing paradigm or field that you're in. So there's a lot of risks involved in there as well. Okay. So again, I encourage you guys actually to go through, you know, we spent a lot of time going through with our team and our attorneys, going through our risk disclosures of like all the stuff that are involved in options trading. Inside those risk disclosures, counterparty risks, like the risk that somebody else doesn't make good on their investment or a broker blows up or whatever. You should understand all these. Take some time to read some of these. The OIC has some great stuff on this as well. But you really should understand how these contracts work. If you do, that'll get you a lot of the way there. Also, position sizing, like we talked about, diversification, like these things are in your control and can help reduce the risks of you blowing yourself up if you're starting options trading. You just actually have to choose to do them. So I can talk all day, all night on this podcast or on our videos about these risks, but if you don't choose to do anything with them, then it's up to you, right? That's on you. Okay, number 11. How do I calculate profit and loss for an options trade? Now, this is a little bit of a nuanced question because there's no one way to do this. So what I will do here is I will point you to one of our resources that we have on Option Alpha. Again, it's always free. It's inside of our education and it's our option strategy section. And inside of our option strategy section, it goes through the 36 popular option strategies that people use, like iron condors, iron butterflies, credit spreads, etc. And it shows you all of those different strategies that people like to use and how you can calculate the break-even price, your profit, your loss on every single one of those strategies. We give you beautiful payoff diagrams, examples, videos in many cases of how to calculate these. There's no one way to do it, but the key component to understanding how to calculate profit and loss is understanding strike prices and understanding premiums. And so if you understand those two basic components, you can eventually get to calculating profits and losses or potential profits and losses for your option strategies that you're trading. If you don't understand what a strike price is, that's not going to help. And if you don't understand what an option premium is, the cost to get into that contract, so how much I pay if I'm an option buyer and how much I collect if I'm an option seller, if you don't understand those, which is why we spend so much time going through those on the podcast, you will never understand how to calculate profits and losses, but they are different for different strategies. A long call option has a different way of calculating the maximum profit compared to an iron condor. And so they are a little bit different. There's no one way to do it. Number 12, how do I manage risk in my options trading portfolio? Again, massive rabbit hole we could go down here, but I will give you some key things that I think that you should do to help manage your risk inside of your portfolio. Number one, I think that you need to trade smaller position sizes. Nobody here, Nobody listening to this podcast can ever show me a case where I've ever said you should trade the largest position size possible on planet Earth because you should trade the largest position size. No, I fully believe that you should trade small position sizes. What I mean by that is you shouldn't have too much risk in any single trade, more specifically, any single ticker symbol that you're trading. As a benchmark, not the golden rule, but as a benchmark, I like less than 5% of risk associated to any single ticker symbol that I'm trading. So if I'm trading Apple, I do not want all the trades that I do in Apple, the summation of everything I do, whether it's one trade or a bunch of trades spread out over different contracts and expirations, it doesn't matter. All the risk that I have in Apple wrapped up into one calculation should never be more than 5% of my account. Again, I think this is a good guidepost. I don't think this is the golden rule. Some people say, well, what if it's 6%? Whatever, it's your choice. I'm just telling you what I think you should do, because based on math and probabilities, the likelihood that you blow yourself up increases dramatically when you start to get over 5%, 10% of risk in a single ticker symbol, right? It just makes logical sense. That's like you putting all of your eggs on one basket, on one card, on one pull, on one thing. Logically, it doesn't make sense, but yet people do it all the time in trading. It's one of the things that leads to a lot of traders blowing themselves up. So please manage your risk by trading with small position sizes. Number two, I think that you should be a net option seller over a net option buyer. Statistically, it's just a better place to be. It means that you should sell insurance versus buy insurance. If you buy insurance or you're buying options, you have to get the direction right and you have to get the timing right. I don't know about any of you, but I have yet to get timing and direction right, and I've yet to get it right consistently so I can make a lot of money buying options. I'm not good at guessing direction. I'm definitely not good at guessing timing or choosing timing of that direction as well. And so for that reason, there's a lot of studies and research that shows that being an option seller is a lot more profitable long-term if you can manage your risk than being an option seller. Number three, I think that what you should do is you should diversify into uncorrelated assets. What I mean by this is do not diversify into more ticker symbols, thinking that diversifying into more symbols means that you're diversified. Because if all of those symbols are very, very correlated with one another, then that doesn't really help you out. So for example, if you are trading and you say, Kirk, I diversified because I was trading Meta, which is Facebook, I was trading Microsoft, and I was trading, I don't know, Twilio or something, right? Like those are all big tech companies. Well, you're probably not that diversified because the likelihood is that those companies are going to move really, really similar to one another. It's like trading Exxon and Mobil, or what, I don't think Mobil trades anymore, but let's say Exxon and Shell or whoever. Like trading two oil companies doesn't mean you're diversified. You maybe a little bit, but you're still really concentrated in oil. Instead, what you should do is you should trade uncorrelated asset classes, or as uncorrelated as asset classes can be. So instead of trading two companies that are in oil, trade an oil company or an oil ETF and a bond ETF. Trade a gold ETF. Trade the US markets and emerging markets. Trade a financial ETF and a utilities and a retail. Like diversify out as much as possible. It really reduces the systemic risk that one potential thing blows you up. And that really is the key to being successful in this business, is making sure you don't blow yourself up. Okay, the last thing that I would say just on this, and I'm sure there's more here, but managing risk inside of your options portfolio is use something, some tool to stay consistent. Stop switching the game every 10 minutes. You are not, as I've said so many times, you are not a rodeo cowboy that should go into the market every day, whiz bang, shooting all over the place, trying to hunt and kill large prey game trades, and then hunt and prey and kill the next day. No, you are a farmer. And so that means that as a farmer, you're going to plant seeds, you're going to sow those seeds, and you're going to reap the benefits of the long-term probabilities and math that you stick to, which means you need a system to keep you consistent. Don't falter in your system. Research, build a system, develop a trading system, adapt a trading system to your needs, and then you have to follow it. Like, you got to stick to the plan, because every time you deviate, it's like resetting the clock. You're pushing yourself back a little bit. And I think that really, really does hurt people long-term with their risk management, okay? So position sizing, diversification, keeping cash on hand is another good one. Like, all of those things will help out in managing your risk in your portfolio. And then the other intricacies like profit-taking or stop-losses or all that, we could go through that in other podcast videos. But in this case, I want to get those big items in place. Okay, number 13, should I use technical analysis to inform my options trading decisions? The reality of this one is you can, okay? You can. That doesn't mean that you have to. It doesn't mean it's necessary. I do believe that technical analysis, depending on how you set up the technical indicators, can help out. I use technical analysis in a lot of my bots. Is it the basis for my trading decisions? No. So it helps tilt some decisions. It helps maybe skew some decisions where I lean a little bit more bullish or lean a little bit more bearish on decisions based on technicals. But by no means am I looking at the technicals and saying, this is the most important thing I should do only because of this indicator. No, it is one data point of a lot of data points that would eventually give me confidence to make a trade. And the way that I always describe this is that, to use the analogy of real estate, because people love to look at real estate and everyone understands real estate, is if you were buying real estate, would you only look at the proximity to the beach? Would that be the only thing that you would care about, right? Is, let's say, the proximity to the beach and the average temperature. Those are like technical indicators because they could move and shift, right? Proximity to the beach could be close or far. But no, those are not the only things that you would look for if you were going to buy an investment property near the beach or an Airbnb or something like that. What you look for are probably more things than that, but would those factors influence your decision? Probably. And I think you should use technical analysis, or any other analysis for that matter, to help inform your decisions. I actually think that the way ChatGPT framed this was great. Like, should it help inform your decisions? Certainly, it should help inform your decisions. And I think that using them can certainly help out, can tilt things a little bit more in your favor, maybe help you get out of good trades and help you avoid dumb or bad trades. But it doesn't mean that you should use them as the only factor for making decisions, okay? Now, the great thing about using technicals is when you pair this with things that we talked about before, like proper position sizing, risk management, staying generally neutral, right? Undefined positions, lots of tickers, diversity. It makes for a great recipe, generally, across the board. Number 14, can you use charts and graphs to trade options? I think the genesis of this one, and I left this one in here from ChatGPT without modifying this one, because this is a question it literally asked. But if I were to guess, I would say that most of the core element that derived this question from ChatGPT when it was doing its research online or reading thousands of things that people do was this idea of just, can you chart and use charting, like chart patterns, maybe candlesticks, maybe chart patterns like pennants and flags and rising wedges and head and shoulders and stuff like that. Can you use those to trade options? And again, just like technical analysis, of course you can. Now, I got to be honest with you, I've never been really good at this. I certainly drool over the traders who are good at this. I envy traders who have that skill. Peter Brandt is a great example of this. He has that skill. I don't have that skill. That's not a skill that I have developed over the years. I probably can identify some, but I can't certainly or haven't been able to trade on them by any good measure. Now, can I look at a chart and say, well, I think this, you know, looks like charting wise, it's setting up to be a rising wedge or a pennant or whatever? Yes. And might that inform some of my decisions? Maybe before, probably not so much now with bots because I trade exclusively with bots anyway, but it might have informed some of my decisions before, right? I think it can inform some of your decisions. The only thing that I have with charting in general, not that it doesn't work, because clearly some people have made it work, is I think it's very hard to make it work because it is subjective. And what I like about the way that I personally trade, and this could be you but different, but the way I personally trade is more based on math and numbers and probabilities, which are less subjective than where do I draw this line on the chart. Because where you draw the line on the chart has a big determination of where you enter and exit trades and how you determine profit ranges and stop losses. And it's based on a subjective opinion of drawing lines and seeing things in a chart that may or may not exist. I don't know. Again, some people are really good at this, and I envy those people. And I think that it's great that they have that skill. I wish I had that skill. I just don't. And so my style of trading is a lot more based on math and probabilities as opposed to the opposite. But it can inform your decisions. And sure, you could look at a chart and say, holy crap, this thing has gone parabolic and, you know, is due for a big correction. Like, yes, that would, you know, I'd be willing to place little bets on some of those things like that. But it doesn't mean that it's the basis for all trading that I do. Okay, number 15. This one's a good wrap up, but I think it's a great one that kind of closes things out here for us a little bit, which is, what are some common mistakes to avoid when trading options? Well, you could probably guess from the latter half of this podcast that I've got a lot of common mistakes that people can go through, but let me just rifle some of these off as they come to me, because I think there's no end to common mistakes that people make. And frankly, that's a good thing, because I make a lot of mistakes still to this day. There's still things that I do in my trading where I'm like, why did I do that? Or how can I improve? That is the game to me. Like, that's the game of investing and trading, is to constantly improve yourself as a trader, as an investor, to hone your skills. And I think there's no end in sight for course correcting and fixing things that you do all the time. Okay. Number one mistake for sure is position sizing. I think without a doubt, if you really argued with somebody, if you really took someone that said, I tried, and here's one that bugs me to no end. Okay. So if you've listened the whole way in this podcast, you're probably locked in with me on this one. But if you haven't, you won't even hear this anyway. People will often come to traders and to anybody and say, I tried that, it didn't work, or some form of that. And it happens all over the place. So, I tried this and it didn't work. I tried that and it didn't work, right? And the reality is that I think that when it comes to trading, they might have tried it, but they tried it with too big of a position size. I would argue is 90% of the problem. And I see lots of data on people making trades and how traders are doing inside of Option Alpha. I am still shocked at how large position sizes are for lots of traders. And I look at some traders who might be, like, you know, doing really well with their trading strategies, and they post about it in the community, and I'm thinking, man, I see that your position size here is really big, you know, like you're on borrowed time. I don't know how that works out in the grand scheme of things, and I hope it goes well for them, but I think most traders who really fail are too large in their position sizing. Again, because they don't understand what options are. They haven't had the education I hope I gave you today, and understanding I hope I gave you today. And they don't understand the risk, so they just go too large because they're going for the, you know, looking for the upside without actually taking a glance at the downside risk. So that's the number one thing, I think, is trading too large. Trading too concentrated, we talk about, right? You've got to trade multiple ticker symbols in different uncorrelated asset classes or industries. You cannot trade the same thing over and over again. You certainly can't trade your whole account there. Number three is not having enough cash on hand to weather some volatility storms. Look, markets are extremely unpredictable. They are by no means perfectly efficient, perfectly rational, normally distributed. They are very, very volatile. And they're getting more volatile by the day, it seems like, or the week. And so as a result, you have to have cash on hand. Cash is tricky because cash theoretically burns a hole in your pocket because you want to use it. You think that there's no value in the cash sitting there. Now, lately, we've had more value in cash sitting because we can actually collect interest on that cash. But there is optionality in cash that you just can't get. And believe me, when volatility events happen like 2022 and 2018, 2016, and all these other ones that have happened before, you need cash. You don't need something that can be transferred in 2 days and whatever. No, you need it that day. So just have it. Have the optionality that gives you cash. It also gives you a lot of peace of mind. A lot of traders don't stick to a plan. In fact, if I even asked them what their trading plan is, it would be some sort of mumbo jumbo of like a little bit of terminology. Maybe they look at some indicators. They have no concrete plan. I don't care if your plan is two things. Get a stinking trading plan. Because if you don't have a plan, a strategy, a way that you're going to tackle things, a defined edge that you're going after, what are you doing other than wasting your own time and money trying to speculate and guess? That's the harsh reality of trading. If you don't have a plan, then you're just going to whimsically come into this thing. You're going to flop around like a cat on a marble floor, and you're not going to find any success. And then you're going to blame everybody else. Okay. So have a plan, because it's on you to have a plan. It's not that hard. It's not that complicated. The next thing that you need to do, execute your plan. This means you have to execute your plan and you can't deviate from that plan. It doesn't mean that you can't change your plan later. It doesn't mean that you can't review your trading strategy and make adaptations and changes, but you got to execute your plan to see if it actually works. This is the hardest part about trading, is actually coming in and making the trades. It's why we built Option Alpha, so you can execute a trading plan automatically and do what you do best, which is not sit there and enter trades and watch markets and make decisions. You need to have something that executes your plan, but you got to execute your plan. The last thing that I would say is have the longest mindset possible of anybody. I often see a lot of people come in. Just recently in the community, people come in and they're like, hey, I came in, I'm really excited, I'm looking to generate 20% a month. And I'm like, oh my God, you got to have a long mindset here, because you need to be able to weather lots of storms. I personally go into this thinking I'm going to have many years of drawdowns. I may go through years of being underwater on positions on the portfolio. I may go through that, and I'm okay with that. It's going to take a lot of trades, a lot of occurrences, but I know my North Star that I'm going after, and I believe it's achievable. Statistically, mathematically, it's achievable. I can do it, right? And I have to have enough patience and enough humility to go through that entire period, which might take decades to go through. And I think that if you have that mindset coming in, it will allow you to more easily weather any short-term storm. So have this long-termism mindset in mind when you come in. And it doesn't mean that this is at odds, because some people say, well, trading is mostly short-term with options contracts. It is if you're trading 30-day or 15-day expirations, but it's the long-term outcome you're after. You're after the outcome after 1,000, 2,000 trades. That's what you're after. It's like, what are those numbers? So that's a big one. The last one, I think I said the last one is this one, but I'll say this one here as the last one, is you have to understand the math, the probabilities, the stats. I firmly believe that most investing is just a game of math and expected outcomes, expected values, understanding of risk. Like, that's all it really is. And once you understand that, then the difference between here today and future, where you it pays off for your investments and the risk that you took, the difference between here and there, that chasm that you're going to cross, that bridge, is just your ability to be patient enough to let the numbers work out. I have religiously said all the time that I think that trading and wealth generation or investing is just a game of math and numbers. And if you're patient enough to let the math and numbers play out over time, and you're consistent enough to not mess with things and to do it right, I think it works out long term. And I don't think a lot of traders have that mindset. They come in with a very short term mindset. They don't have that long termism mindset that is absolutely required and vital to be successful, I believe, in this market. So, all right. That was 15 questions from ChatGPT that are all about options trading. We really covered a large, large swath of information today. I really hope, and I don't know how long this podcast is, but it might be one of my longer ones, I really hope this one was helpful. If you did think that it was helpful, please take a moment. Please leave us a rating and review on iTunes or Spotify or Google Play or wherever you listen to the podcast. It would really help out. The second thing I would ask is, please send this to a trading friend. If you know someone interested in options trading, someone you think might be interested, I hope that this is the start of a really fascinating career that you might have, or at least a fascinating investing journey that you might go on in options trading, because I really believe that options trading is quite possibly one of the most revolutionary things for investors, and gives you so much power, so much flexibility, so much choice, all in control of a better investing environment than just hoping and praying that the markets go up for years on end, which is not a good idea. I think that options trading gives you more than everything else out there as far as investing. And that's why I'm so passionate about being here and teaching about it and getting more people on here, because I want more people to have that optionality. So please send this to a friend, somebody you know who might be interested in it. Please share it. It would really, really help us out. Finally, because we can't go through every single thing here on this podcast, though I certainly did try here today with this one because it was quite a long one, we can't go through everything on the podcast, and that is why we have so much education and training completely free, as always, right at Option Alpha. You can just go to optionalpha.com/education. That is where you see all of our options trading education, 100% free. Everything about strategies, free research and data that we do, courses, and then of course our options trading handbook, which is just keeps growing by the day. We have literally time that we set aside every month to just write dozens and dozens of new articles on topics that a lot of traders ask, but just nobody covers. And we give that away completely for free and spend our time and attention and energy in that direction, because we think that if we can educate a lot of people in this industry, that helps out everybody. So please check it all out. You can head over to optionalpha.com/education. That's where you see all of our free education and deep dive into this. Explore different topics that are important to you, like trading psychology or technical indicators or options pricing. Or I want to learn about options theories like the efficient frontier and black swan events and unsystemic risks. Like, all of that stuff is all in there. We recently expanded our section on economics and risk management and investment account types. So we've got all that in there for you to use. It's right at your fingertips, completely free, ad-free inside of our entire website. We have no ads or no banners that are going to fly out from the side and kind of interrupt your experience. We don't believe in that. We've never had that. That's why I think a lot of people like using our site for education. So please dive into our free education. Let us know how it helps or not. Give us feedback. What else we can do here on the podcast or in the education to help you as a trader in your journey.
Thanks for listening to the Option Alpha podcast. If you liked what you heard, please drop by iTunes and leave a rating or comment. Plus, you can get everything. Free email updates for future shows, transcripts, video tutorials, case studies, and more. Just visit our website at optionalpha.com.
All right, that's a wrap for this week's podcast episode here at Option Alpha. But before you go, please again take a moment of your time to rate and review this show. If it's helpful, please help spread the word about what we're doing here at Option Alpha. That's how we reach more traders. Just word of mouth, reviews by traders like you. We don't do advertising on social media or anything like Google Ads or anything. So just please help us spread the word about what we're doing here at Option Alpha. That would truly help us out. Also, don't forget to connect with us on your favorite social media platform so you can stay up to date with all of the latest happenings inside of the Option Alpha community. As always, I truly hope you guys enjoyed today's show. Got at least one thing out of it that you can apply right now to help you consistently play smarter trades. And until next time, happy trading.